Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who takes a critical look at the political and military situation in Afghanistan, which has become America's forgotten war. John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, who assesses the U.S. media's coverage of the Iraq War and the unfolding CIA leak scandal. And Annie Strickler of the Sierra Club, who explains what's at stake in the fight over drilling for oil in Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
New York State National Guardsman General Matthew fell lucky just to return home from Iraq in one piece. His time in Iraq was spent transporting equipment contaminated with depleted uranium, or DU. So he took up an offer by the New York Daily News to get tested. His result came back positive. He then urged his pregnant wife to get an ultrasound. They discovered his unborn daughter had only two fingers on one hand, a common condition created by radioactive exposure. Now a year old, she is otherwise in good health. According to the news magazine In These Times, the U.S. military has greatly expanded its use of DU ammunition in Iraq, from tank shells to huge bunker buster bombs and pistol ammo shells. When deployed, DU ammo creates a cloud of microparticles that remain radioactive for billions of years. Matthew now says the military misinformed him about the hazards of DU ammo. They told us we didn't have to worry unless we had DU fragments in our body. Dr. Doug Roki ran a health study on DU for the Pentagon in the mid-1990s and concluded it was not safe to use in any weapons. The Pentagon quickly denounced his research. In recent months, the states of Connecticut and Louisiana passed laws allowing National Guard troops to request specialized DU contamination tests at the Pentagon's expense. As Connecticut State Representative Pat Dillon, the sponsor of the bill, said, "These are our kids and someone needs to protect them." A new joint Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International study found over 2,200 Americans are serving life sentences without parole for crimes they committed as children. This is contrary to international legal practice enacted by the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, which bans life sentences for children. Only the U.S. and Somalia have declined to sign on to the Child Rights Treaty. Alison Parker, a researcher for Human Rights Watch, remarked that people under 18 are too young to vote or buy cigarettes and should be too young to spend the rest of their lives behind bars. The number of child offenders in America who are serving sentences of life without parole spiked in the 1980s with a bipartisan crusade to get tough on crime. In fact, the proportion of young people given life sentences for murder has grown 300% over the last decade. The 157-page report called The Rest of Their Lives shows that child murderers are now more likely to get life sentences without parole than adult criminals for felony murder. Last spring, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed many international guidelines that protect child rights in its decision to ban the execution of child offenders, finding young people less culpable for criminal acts than adults. When Donna Harvey, a public school teacher, returned to look at a friend's home in Moreau, Louisiana, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, she saw a house surrounded by a large dark ring of oil. Harvey told Salon.com, "Oil is everywhere. It is encrusted on the vehicles. It's on the houses. She was even standing in it." The oil came from a nearby Murphy Oil Company storage tank. High winds broke one of the storage tanks, dumping crude oil into floodwaters, sewers, and swimming pools. The Coast Guard estimates that 800,000 gallons of black crude leaked into the neighborhood. Overall, Hurricane Katrina caused 40 oil spills, dumping more than 8 million gallons of crude oil along the Gulf Coast. The Coast Guard estimates 55,000 barrels of oil need to be cleaned up. In the weeks after Katrina, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency warned returning citizens to wear gloves, goggles, and respiratory protection. However, eco-activists have little faith in the EPA and state agencies to protect public health amid the drive to start rebuilding. Officially, the EPA says the level of benzene, a known cancer-causing agent, is slightly elevated at the Murphy oil site, But inside the testing data, the benzene level is 45 times higher than the state health standard. The National Resources Defense Council and a community group, the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, are conducting independent scientific tests of the toxic contamination. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The ongoing war in Afghanistan remains overshadowed by the larger conflict in Iraq, but the recent surge in Taliban attacks has many observers concerned about the direction of Afghanistan. Taliban fighters using improvised explosive devices along roadways, similar to those employed by insurgents in Iraq, have launched almost daily attacks over the past month on U.S., international, and Afghan soldiers and police. An Australian television report recently revealed that U.S. Army soldiers had burned the bodies of two dead Taliban fighters and then used the incident and insults shouted over a loudspeaker as part of a psychological operation in an Afghan village to draw out insurgents. The Islamic faith and the Geneva Conventions both forbid the cremation of fallen combatants, prompting human rights groups to warn that these kinds of tactics are likely to trigger a violent backlash against American troops. Further, Afghanistan's September ballot for parliament and provincial councils has resulted in the election of some powerful warlords, some of whom have joined President Hamid Karzai's government. Many of these warlords have been condemned for their abuse of power and human rights violations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission. He takes a critical look at the political and military situation in Afghanistan, which has become America's forgotten war.
Afghanistan just had its first parliamentary elections in 40 years, since 1969. And what has happened is our country has gone into Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban in 2001 and essentially replace them with warlords and drug lords who are just as bad and in some cases worse. They've put into place a system which is a democracy in name because it has elections and a constitution, but the Afghan democracy has not really had much input from the people of Afghanistan. We're just getting results from the parliamentary elections that took place last month, an election in which about 50% of the voters countrywide voted. In some provinces, it was as low as 30%. In Kabul province, the province where the capital is, about 36% of eligible voters or of registered voters voted. And the results look pretty grim. At least half of the seats, 249 seats in the parliament, were won by what the New York Times called religious figures or former fighters. So essentially, these are leaders with either a record of atrocities or having Taliban-like stances on issues like women's rights and secular government. So this is the situation that's occurred in Afghanistan since the U.S. has toppled the Taliban in 2001. And meanwhile, you've got U.S. troops operating in the countryside, supposedly tracking down terrorists, but mostly terrorizing the population themselves.
As we talk about the U.S. troops that are currently in Afghanistan, there has been an escalation of attacks by the Taliban, attacks on American troops, international troops, and, of course, the Afghani police and military. How serious a threat are those remnants of the Taliban armed forces in trying to destabilize the government the U.S. has set up there?
It's hard to tell how much of a potential the Taliban have of really taking over. I think at the moment it's not a big possibility, but it really depends, I think, on how people in the countryside, people where the Taliban operate, perceive them and their message as one of fighting the U.S. as an unjust occupation, which it is. Every time the U.S. does something like, for example, this current scandal of burning Taliban prisoners and declaring how great they were for doing that. And every time they do something like that, or every time news comes out of Afghans getting tortured, or every time they break down doors and do house-to-house searches or airstrikes, more and more people will get turned on to the Taliban as the only solution to a situation that's getting worse and worse. I mean, most people don't want the Taliban, but they don't want what the U.S. has brought them. They don't want the U.S. troops, and they don't want the warlords in power. This parliamentary election, where we see many warlords getting back into power officially now, less than 50% in most provinces of the registered voters actually voted, which, and many voters, according to reports, said right out that we didn't vote because all our choices were warlords. So, I mean, people don't want warlords. They don't want a Taliban-style government, so that they wouldn't back, you know, this insurgency. And I think that that's what the Taliban would need for the insurgency to have any sort of possibility of gaining ground against the U.S. and the Afghan government.
James Ingalls, both before and after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the president and the First Lady Laura Bush were talking about the liberation of the women in Afghanistan from Taliban rule, which certainly treated women very harshly as second-class citizens. What's the status of women now in Afghanistan? Your organization certainly focuses your attention on that.
Women in Afghanistan have one of the worst standards of living of women anywhere in the world. I mean, that just goes even without looking at the gender issues. You know, Afghanistan is down at number 5 from the bottom of U.S. human development standards. But in terms of the way women's lives are even below that, I mean, none of this, I guess, you could say that this is due to a lot of history in addition to what the U.S. has done. But what the U.S. has done is not advanced women's rights to the level at which they claim they were doing. For one thing, all the warlords that were put into power, most of them have extremely Taliban-like stances on women's rights. Ismail Khan, who was the governor in Herat, who Donald Rumsfeld said was an appealing person, had a Taliban-like dress code, you know, and chastity police who would take women to the hospital to check and make sure that they were still virgins. And this was after the U.S. brought him back to power. The U.S. has enabled a Taliban-like rule in many areas of the country. The situation is not anything to be proud of.
That was James Ingalls, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission. Contact the group by calling area code 626-676-7884 or visit their website at www.afghanwomensmission.org. The White House, now embroiled in a major scandal involving the most senior White House aides, Karl Rove and Louis Libby, still struggles to paint an optimistic picture of the war in Iraq. But with the death toll of U.S. soldiers now reaching the 2,000 mark and a solid majority of the American people believing that the war was a mistake, President Bush has an ever tougher job selling his stay-the-course Iraq policy. Despite the apparent passage of a draft constitution for Iraq in the October 15th referendum, the insurgents capitalizing on ethnic and religious polarization continue to launch deadly attacks on military and civilian targets. 3 suicide bombs carried in vehicles exploded in quick succession October 24th near the Palestine and Sheraton hotels, the base for many foreign reporters. The blasts killed an estimated 20, but would have been far more deadly had one of the bombs, concealed in a cement mixer, reached its intended target, the Palestine Hotel. Critics of the Bush administration's pre-war campaign to win support for the Iraq invasion point to the complicity of the media as cheerleaders rather than skeptics when the policy could have been challenged and reversed. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John R. MacArthur, author of a book covering the 1991 Iraq War titled Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, assesses the U.S. media's coverage of the Iraq War and the unfolding CIA leak scandal.
I wrote a piece inspired by the uncut version of Apocalypse Now. I urge people to sit through the whole thing, because some of the things that were cut years ago and restored whenever it was 2, 3, 4 years ago are remarkable. And the most remarkable scene is where Marlon Brando tortures Martin Sheen, who's been sent to catch him and kill him. by reading these awful Time magazine dispatches or articles about how the light's at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam and how their latest expert sources tell them that the United States has turned the corner and that the Vietnamese army is becoming self-sufficient and the Vietnamization is working and so on. And I noticed the parallels with the New York Times coverage of what I call Iraqization, where you'll probably notice, not just in the Times, but in all the media, lots of upbeat stories about how the Iraqi army is really getting its act together and killing a lot of guerrillas or insurgents, as they call them. And it sounds just like the way they promoted Vietnamization. It's bad news in the sense that it means that we're going down the same path and that a lot more people are going to get killed for no reason. It's maybe good news in an odd way because it's maybe the preface to a withdrawal that the United States really is thinking about getting out. Because otherwise, why would they sell these nonsensical stories about the Iraqi army getting its act together? And when we know that they don't have their act together, the Iraqi army, such as it is shot through with spies, insurgent plants, people with divided loyalties who will sit by and watch a firefight rather than participate on the side of the Americans.
How big is the gulf, in your view, between the happy face situation in Iraq being spun by the White House and the Pentagon and the realities there on the ground? And how much do you think the American people know about that gap, if they do at all?
I don't think they know that much. You know, there's wishful thinking right now in the Andy Bush camp that Hurricane Katrina and the constant flow of bad news from Iraq is going to somehow turn things around and push Bush out or force him to withdraw from Iraq. But I'm not persuaded that enough people have seen enough American dead or enough American failure to actually pull the plug on the occupation. And of course, the Democratic Party is doing its level best to not to address the issue. So there's no really organizing focal point for anti-war people. But in terms of just ordinary folks getting the information they need, very hard to say that they're getting what they need. First, reporters are justifiably terrified to go out and do their jobs. I wouldn't do it if I were there. I wouldn't go. I mean, it's just absolutely hair-raising. And they're not making distinctions between pro- or anti-war journalists or journalists who say, don't worry, I'm trying to tell your side of the story. They just grab whoever's available. So there's that. And then there's, of course, the still very effective propaganda machine coming out of the White House. And just I challenge you all to read your local newspapers and look at the number of stories that turn up on the front page that announce an Iraqi regular army raid or an American counterattack or the routing of some viper's nest of guerrillas as though we were actually winning. And it's crazy. We're losing. We're losing, and we're going to have to leave eventually.
When you look at sort of the propaganda campaign that was launched to justify the war against Iraq and the target being the American people, what do you think the media in this country should be focusing on in terms of the larger story of this scandal? Because it's not just about Joe Wilson. It's not just about Valerie Plame.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, the real story is how did they manufacture the story? Who did they get to promote it for them? Was Judith Miller their prime spokesman, or did they have other people at the New York Times and the Washington Post at higher levels? Did they brief the publishers? It's perfectly possible in the old days, in the 60s, when JFK or Nixon had or Johnson had something they wanted to get in the newspaper, they would call the publisher or they would call the editor or they would call one of the top columnists. And then the publishers flattered that the president or whomever has called them, and the word goes down the line, government is telling the truth. The White House is telling the truth. Don't contradict it. And I think maybe something like that happened. But that requires a kind of internal affairs unit like the police department has in most cities to bust the people within newspapers. We don't have any such thing. I've done it myself But believe me, it takes a lot of work to get inside a newspaper and to get the higher-ups to tell you what really happened. But that's the kind of reporting that has to be done, is on how the newspapers got used.
That was John R. MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of the book Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, published by University of California Press. Visit Harper's Magazine website at www.harpers.org. Drilling for oil in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, came one step closer to approval last week. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee approved opening part of the 1.5 million-acre refuge to drilling in order to raise $2.4 billion over 5 years. The argument in favor of the bill was based in part on the idea that revenue generated would help pay for reconstruction costs in the hurricane-battered Gulf Coast. While neither supporters nor opponents of drilling are claiming that passing legislation this year will do anything in the short term to reduce high gasoline prices, supporters do say that once the oil from ANWR is flowing, it should help ease the tight supply of oil and eventually reduce prices. But critics note that no oil would flow for at least 10 years after passage of the proposed legislation. An amendment sponsored by Democrats that would have prohibited the export of oil from ANWR was defeated, ensuring that if the bill is passed in its present form, some of the oil will be sold outside the U.S. The main rationale for drilling in ANWR put forward by proponents is that the project would reduce dependence on foreign oil. But one Democratic senator maintains that over the next 20 years, such dependence would be reduced only slightly, from 68% to 64%. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Annie Strickler, spokesperson for the Sierra Club, about what's at stake in this fight and what opponents of drilling in ANWR are doing to defeat the measure.
It's a pretty slim amount of oil up in the Arctic Refuge. We're looking at somewhere, the best guess is somewhere less than a year's supply worth of oil, and it wouldn't be online for at least a decade. And the impact on gas prices is going to be even smaller. A report from the Energy Information Administration just this past summer revealed that at peak production in about 20 years, that's in 2025, Arctic drilling would only have the impact of reducing gas prices at the pump by about a penny.
In the wake of the impact of Hurricane Katrina on oil production, President Bush has recently, for the first time, called on Americans to conserve energy. Do you think that that was just rhetoric, or do you see any policies or initiatives coming out of the White House that would help reduce demand for oil?
Well, it would certainly be nice if the administration matched its rhetoric with reality and with the programs it's promoting. In fact, the Congress passed and the president signed an energy bill just this past summer, about 2 months before President Bush started talking about conservation, and this energy bill paid just a little bit of lip service to conservation, but in reality, it gave away billions of dollars in subsidies to the same polluting oil and gas industries, and really is just more of the same old energy policy. The programs that we really need to be talking about, including conservation and other things such as making cars go farther on a gallon of gas, promoting energy efficiency, all of that is pretty much lacking leadership from the president and from Congress right now.
The oil industry says it would only be operating in a very small part of ANWR, and that new technology allows for the extraction of oil with very little impact on the ecosystem, including the animals and the people who live there. Couldn't that be possible so it wouldn't really be a big problem to drill in ANWR?
Well, the interesting thing is they like to say, members of Congress and the oil and gas industry like to say that the drilling will be kept to 2,000 acres, which is a huge myth, and it's one that's been perpetuated, unfortunately. But in reality, there are no limitations, and that drilling infrastructure, the roads, the pipelines, the airstrips, all of that could spread across the entire 1.5 million-acre coastal plain. It's kind of like looking at the surface of a table, and what they're saying is that where the legs of the table actually hit the ground, that's the only part that we're going to count in that 2,000 acres. But in reality, that table obviously covers a lot more ground. So, you know, all you have to do is kind of picture the gravel roads and the airstrips and the pipelines and all of the infrastructure that goes along with oil and gas drilling to understand how far this will sprawl. Not to mention, we're talking about drilling for oil in a national wildlife refuge, and it's simply not fair to be able to say that you can protect the refuge, the wilderness there, the wildlife there, the native people there, and still drill for oil.
If the House votes in favor of the same language that the Senate approved last week, is there anything that can be done to defeat the drilling proposal?
Yeah, there are. There are a couple of very crucial votes coming up. The House Resources Committee is going to mark up its reconciliation package. It will have the same Arctic drilling provisions as the Senate committee did, which voted in favor of that last week. The House version is also going to include a provision for offshore drilling, which, again, is very controversial. The full House is expected to vote on the full budget reconciliation package the week of November 7th. So that will be a critical vote, both for protecting the Arctic Refuge as well as protecting America's coastlines. And then the Senate will follow suit with a vote on their reconciliation package later in the month. Obviously, they have a couple of big-ticket items, including a Supreme Court nomination, to deal with first.
The Sierra Club is a member of the Alaska Coalition, which is a broad umbrella group trying to stop drilling in ANWR. What is the Sierra Club asking people to do, or what is the Alaska Coalition asking people to do? Are they sort of leading the charge in this effort?
All of us are working in coalition together, and the ask of folks, of citizens across the country, is plain and simple. It's to call or write your members of Congress, both your representatives in the House and your senators, and tell them to vote against any budget package that includes Arctic drilling provisions. You know, the budget is actually becoming a more and more controversial measure day by day. It includes, you know, cuts to Medicaid, cuts to student aid, a drilling off our coast, drilling in the Arctic. A lot of this is being done under the banner of Hurricane Katrina relief or the offsets or just kind of exploiting the tragedies of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita to further their agendas.
That was Annie Strickler of the Sierra Club. For more information about the fight to save ANWR, call the club at area code 202-547-1141 or visit www.arcticrefugeaction.org, the website of a coalition of conservation, labor, and religious groups who are working to preserve the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.